This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org. T.C. Boyle with Michael Silverblatt, recorded in Santa Fe on May 10, 2006. T.C. Boyle is a prodigious fiction writer with 10 potent novels and counting. Boyle is also a virtuoso short story writer and always hip to the latest in social culture that he delights in skewering with his trademark wit. After reading from his work, T.C. Boyle joins in conversation with Michael Silverblatt, host and producer of the premier literary talk show on radio, Bookworm.
Thank you. My name's Michael Silverblatt, and, before I make my little announcements, what a good time you're going to have tonight. I just want to confide that to you. I want to let you know that next week there's a reading. This is the first time I've ever stayed for an entire week in Santa Fe, and I'll be here next week to talk to Stuart Dybeck. I gather that there are still tickets. Now, I hear that that's because you don't know who Stuart Dybeck is. If you did know, you'd all have your tickets all in hand. So don't be fooled by not knowing the name. He's a remarkable writer, a sweet writer, and his readings are fantastic. He's a fabulous reader. It's going to be a reading that you'll be talking about afterwards. So pick up the tickets for it. There are still some available. And, you know, you really want to hear this guy. He's very special. Okay. Here we go. I first heard Tom Boyle, then known as T. Caragason Boyle, read when his first book came out. I'm the ship of the desert. I don't need any water. And I was working at the time at a small bookstore in Santa Monica. It was called Intellectuals and Liars. It was. I was a liar, hoping someday to make it across the border to being an intellectual, but not quite being sure how. At the store, there was someone named Randy Signor, and no matter what book I'd recommend, he would say, "Yeah, but Tom Boyle has a new story out. You can't believe Tom Boyle. Oh my God, I can't believe this guy." These were the first stories. They were coming out in literary magazines. And then sure enough, when that first book came out, Descent of Man, it was announced that he'd read at the bookstore. And this Randy Signor guy was hopping and skipping around the store, you know, looking like a gazelle. And, he wouldn't believe a fanatical level of fan. And in came Tom Boyle. It was a store small enough that it didn't need a microphone. A microphone would have overwhelmed it, and announced that he was going to read one of his hilarious stories. And that began a kind of love affair on my part. When I got my own radio show, he was one of the first guests on the show. He's been on repeatedly. There's been a kind of hiatus here, and broken by the soon-to-be appearance of this new novel called Talk Talk. Now, Boyle has gone from the absolutely hilarious to the heartbreaking, the extravagantly overwhelming. I remember when the first novel, Water Music, came out, it had won something repeatedly in the Paris Review called the Aga Khan Humor Prize. And I thought, the Aga Khan Humor Prize? I didn't know he had a sense of humor. I just thought he had a lot of money. but nevertheless, it was the best humor prize and remains so. For fiction published in the Paris Review. And out came those novels. Among them, let's see, Tortilla Curtain keeps getting chosen around the Southwest. You know that One Book, One City program? They choose Tortilla Curtain. He's as close, I would say, as a living kind of classic American. And no matter how traumatic and extreme the stories get, they never stop being funny. He's like our Mark Twain. He continues in a tradition that Kurt Vonnegut still represents that stories and novels should be funny and entertaining, that they need to seduce. One of the few serious American writers who wants to seduce you, to make you laugh, and pardon my saying so, if he had his way, he would make you pee in your pants. That's, you know, the secret desire of Tom Boyle is to make you fall on the floor with laughter. There isn't a lot to say about someone who's been making people laugh for such an extraordinarily long time, with subject matter as grotesque as the disintegration of the human race, the failure of the environment in utter ways, people waking up to find that it's blooding outside, not raining anymore, it's blood. This is, you know, the guy who just now said, in response to the idea that cell phones are toxic, and we're throwing them out at the rate of hundreds and thousands a year, he said, well, I'm going to go to my lab in the basement and invent an edible one. Tom Boyle.
Hello, folks. My great pleasure to be here. I'm coming from one tourist town to another, Santa Barbara to Santa Fe. We have white stucco. You've got brown stucco. Otherwise, it's exactly the same place. I love Michael's introduction. He's wonderful. We've had a long relationship. And of all the praise he just gave me, the adjective I liked best was living. I woke up this morning and I felt myself all over and I had the distinct impression that I'm still alive. And perhaps you can reinforce that tonight. I'll just talk to you a little bit about my method, and then I'll use this portion to demonstrate it by reading you a little bit, some stories, and then, of course, we'll have a discussion afterwards. I have been traveling this past fall with three new titles. One is Tooth and Claw, a collection of new stories that are very various. They run the gamut from a story like Swept Away, which is a story set in Scotland in very much the tall tale mode, right down to a story called Chicxulub, which is a very dramatic, powerful story about loss, to the last story in the book, Up Against the Wall, which is as close as I've ever come to autobiography. And I figure, why not, you know? Anything can be a story, even my own paltry life. I was also traveling with The Inner Circle, which came out in paper this fall. This is my book about Dr. Alfred C. Kinsey's sex researches, and I hold it up here just to warn you. I don't think anyone would want to read it. It's 400 pages of pure sex. The third title that I came out with, which I'm very proud of, I couldn't find a copy to hold up for you. It's called The Human Fly, and it's a book designed for the young adults. Now, I didn't write it specifically for young adults, but one of the children's editors at Penguin said to me, why not make a book for teens? Now, I always presume that teens can read my books if they want, but they have apparently a special section, and teens go in there and read them, so I'm very happy. It's called The Human Fly, as I said, and it's a collection of stories of mine that were selected by the editor. And then I wrote an afterword talking about the valence of each story and how I came about writing it, what I think of it. And I'm absolutely delighted with this. Last Friday, I got a letter from a 14-year-old girl in Maine. And she, very literate, wrote me a long letter saying, in essence, I think you're cool, but you know, I'm cool too. And she sent me one of her stories in testimony. So it's just so rewarding to think that we can reach the young readers out there in the world. It's just wonderful. That said, I think it's time to move on to the performance part of this. I've brought two small stories for you today. I did an interview about a couple of weeks ago, and the interviewer said this, in essence. Here you are, you know, known as the trickster and the wild man of literature, and you've written all these crazy, surreal stories and everything, and now you've matured, and you're so serious. You're writing these serious stories, and I think, the interviewer said, it's because you become a father. Well, it never really occurred to me before, but I thought I'd become a mature writer the way we all become mature, by getting old. And I did take that into consideration in picking the first story for tonight. I very rarely write from personal experience. I'm not the sort of writer like Tom Wolfe, for instance. If Tom Wolfe is going to write about the firehouse, by God, he'll live there for 6 weeks, and he'll tell you how many spots are on the Dalmatian and, you know, what kind of tobacco the fire chief chews and all of that. Well, that's one way of going about it. My way is to just dream. I don't want to go to the firehouse. I don't want to talk to the fire chief. I just want to make it up. In this case, however, this story derives from an experience I had. This protagonist of this story is not me, and he's not very much like me. But here is how the story came about. I don't know if in such a clean, wholesome, healthy, and beautiful city as this, you have a drug problem. But certainly, where I was living in L.A. prior to making my escape to Santa Barbara, there was something of a drug problem going on, especially among children. So we initiated a DARE program, Just Say No, to keep kids off of drugs. I'm sure that you're probably aware of what this is. Do you have such a program here? Okay, good. Here's my response to it, and I have very much mixed feelings. On that particular night, my daughter in the fifth grade asked me to go with her because my wife, to whom I married, still remain married, was away doing something, and so I went with my daughter, unprepared. I had no idea what was going on. It was the culmination of their DARE program. And this story begins with some terms, the kind of terms that you learn for the dreaded SAT exam, because as this man goes back to the school, all of these memories come back to him of his time in school. The story is called Back in the Eocene. Abscissa, ordinate, isosceles, carboniferous, mesozoic, holothurian, the terms come to him in a rush of disinterred syllables, a forgotten language conjured by the sudden sharp smell of chalk dust and blackboards. It happens every time. All he has to do is glance at the bicycle rack out front, or the flag snapping crisply atop the gleaming aluminum pole, and the memories begin to wash over him, a typhoon of faces and places and names, Ilona Sharrow and Richie Davidson, Manifest Destiny, Hetty Greaves, the Sea of Tranquility, and the three longest rivers in Russia. He takes his daughter's hand and shuffles toward the glowing auditorium, already choked up. Inside, it's worse. There, under the pale yellow gaze of the overhead lights, recognition cuts at him like a knife. It's invested in the feel of the hard steel frames and cushionless planks of the seats, in the crackling PA system, and the sad array of frosted cupcakes and chocolate chip cookies presided over by a puffy matron from the PTA. And the smells, pine sole, floor wax, festering underarms and erupting feet. He hasn't had a wax bean, hasn't inserted a wax bean in his mouth in, what, 20 years? The thought overwhelms him, and he stands there awkwardly a moment, just inside the door, and then there's a tug at his hand, and his daughter slips away, flitting through the crowd like a bird to chase after her friends. He finds a seat in back. The big, stark institutional clock shows 8:05. Settling into the unforgiving grip of the chair, he concentrates on the faces of his fellow parents, vaguely familiar from previous incarnations, as they trudge up and down the aisles like automatons. Voices buzz round him in an expectant drone. High heels click on the linoleum. Chairs scrape. He's dreaming a scene from another auditorium an ice age ago. Detention hall, the soporific text, shouts from beyond the windows and a sharp, sweet taste of spring on the air when Officer Rudman steps up to the microphone. A hush falls over the auditorium. The gale of chatter dropping off to a breeze, a stir in the rafters, nothing. His daughter, 10 years old and beautiful, her feet too big and her shoulders slumped, strides up the aisle and drops into the chair beside him as if her legs had been shot out from under her. Dad, she whispers, that's Officer Rudman. He nods. Who else would it be? Up there in his spit and polish, his close-cropped hair and custom-fit uniform? Who else with his sunny smile and weightlifter's torso? Who else but Officer Rudman, coordinator of the school's anti-drug program and heartthrob of all the fifth-grade girls? A woman with frosted hair and remodeled hips ducks in late and settles noiselessly into the chair in front of him. Good evening, Officer Rudman says. I'm Officer Rudman. Someone coughs. Feedback hisses through the speakers. In the next moment, they're clumsily rising in a cacophony of rustling, stamping, and nose-blowing as Officer Rudman leads them in the Pledge of Allegiance. Hands over hearts, a murmur of half-remembered words. He's conscious of his daughter's voice beside him and of his own.
and he shifts his eyes to steal a glimpse of her. Her face is serene, shining, hopeful, a recapitulation and refinement of her mother's, and suddenly it's too much for him, and he has to look down at his feet. With liberty and justice for all. More coughing. The seats creak. They sit. Officer Rudman gives the crowd a good long look, and he begins. Drugs are dangerous, he says. We all know that. And he pauses while the principal, a thick-ankled woman with feathered hair and a dogged expression, translates in her halting Spanish, Las drogas son peligrosas. The man sits there and back, his daughter at his side, tasting wax beans, rushing with Weltschmerz and nostalgia. Eocene, designating or of the earliest epoch of the tertiary period in the Cenozoic era during which mammals became the dominant animals. Je rompe, tu rompes, il rompe, nous rompons, vous rompez, il rompe. They didn't have drugs when he was in elementary school. Didn't have crack and crank, didn't have ice and heroin and AIDS to go with it. Not in elementary school. Not in the 50s. They didn't even have pot. Mary Jane, that's what they called it in the high school health films, but no one ever called it that. Not on this planet, anyway. It was pot, pure and simple, and he smoked it like anyone else. He's remembering his first joint, age 17, a walk up on Broom Street, holes in the walls, bottles, rats, padlocks on the doors, one puff, puff, and you're hooked, when Officer Rudman beckons a skinny, dark-haired kid to the microphone. Big adult hands choke the neck of the stand, and the mic drops a foot. Stretching till his ankles rise up out of his high tops, the kid clutches at the microphone and recites his pledge to stay off drugs in a piping, timbreless voice. My name is Stephen Taylor, and I have good feelings of self-esteem about myself, he says, his super-amplified breathing whistling through the interstices. And I pledge never to take drugs or to put anything bad in my body. If somebody asks me if I want drugs, I will just say no, turn my back, change the subject, walk away, or just say no. Brainwashing. That's what Linda called it when he phoned to break their date for tonight. Easy for her to say, but then she didn't have a daughter, didn't know, couldn't imagine what it was like to feel the net expand beneath you, high out over that chasm of crashing rock. What good did it do you, she said, or me? She had a point. Hash, keef, LSD, cocaine, heroin. He'd heard all the warnings, watched all the movies, but how could you take anyone's word for it? Was it possible, even? He'd sat through driver's ed, sobering statistics, scare films and all, and then taken his mother's Ford out on the highway and burned the tires off it. Scotch, gin, whiskey, Boone's Farm, Night Train, Colt 45, Seconal, Two-and-All, Quaalude. He'd heard all the warnings, yes. But when the time came, he stuck the needle in his arm and drew back the plunger to watch the clear solution flush with his own smoldering blood. You remember to take your vitamins today? My name is Lucy Fidel, and I pledge never to abuse drugs, alcohol, or tobacco because I like myself and the world and my school, and I can get high from just life. My name is Roberto Campos, and I don't want to die from drugs. Peer pressure is what makes kids use drugs, and I will just say no. I will walk away, and I will change the subject. Voy a decir no. Officer Rudman adjusts the microphone, clasps his hands in front of him. The parents lean forward. He holds their eyes. You've all just heard the fifth graders' pledges, he said, and these kids mean it. I'm proud of them. Let's have a big hand for these kids. And there it is, thunderous. All those parents in their suits and sport coats and skirts, wearing sober, earnest, angry looks, pounding their hands together in relief, as if that could do it. As if the force of their acclamation could drive the gangs from the streets or nullify that infinitely seductive question to which no is never the answer. He claps along with them, not daring to glance down at his daughter, picturing the first boy, the skinny dark one, up against the wall with the handcuffs on him, dead in the street, wasting away in some charity ward, and the girl, mother of four, twice divorced, strung out on martinis and diet pills and wielding the Jeep Cherokee like a weapon. That's what it came down to. That's what all the warnings meant. Agon, Agape, Ulysses S. Grant, Parthenogenesis, the Monitor, and the Merrimack. Jan Cassius has a lean and hungry look. His daughter takes his hand. Now there's a movie, she whispers. What happened to finger painting, hearts for Valentine's Day, and bunnies for Easter? Fifth grade, for Christ's sake. Where was Treasure Island? Little Women, Lassie Come Home? What had happened? Who was responsible? Where did it go wrong? He's on the verge of raising his hand and demanding an answer of Officer Rudman, the nostalgia gone sour in his throat now. But the lights dim and the film begins. A flicker of movement on the screen, bars, a jail cell. He watches a junkie writhe and scream, a demonic, sunken-eyed man beating his head against a wall. Someone, somewhere, lights flashing, police, handcuffs, more screams. Smoke a joint and you're hooked. How they laughed over that when he and Tony Gaetti, and laughed again to realize it was true. Cooking the dope in a bottle cap, stealing disposable syringes, getting off in the restroom on the train and feeling they'd snowed the world. Things were different then. That was a long time ago. Cro-Magnon, Neanderthal, Homo erectus. His daughter's hand is crushing him, prim and cool, lying across his palm like a demolished building, a cement truck, glacial moraine. Up on the screen, the junkies are gone now, replaced by a sunny schoolyard and a clone of Officer Rudman. Statistics now, grim but hopeful. Inspiring music, smiling faces, kids who just say no. When it's over, he feels dazed. The lights flashing back on to transfix him like some animal startled along a darkened highway. All he wants is to be out of here. No more questions, no more tricks of memory, no more Officer Rudman or the vapid stares of his fellow parents. Honey, he whispers, bringing his face close to his daughter's. We gotta go. Officer Rudman's chin is cocked back, his arms folded across his chest. Any questions? He asks. But Dad, the cake sale. The cake sale. We're gonna have to miss it this time, he whispers. And suddenly, he's on his feet, slumping his shoulders in the way people do when they duck out of meetings early or come late to the concert or theater, a gesture of submission and apology. His daughter hangs back. She wants to stay, wants cake, wants to see her friends. But he tugs at her hand, and then they're fighting their way through the gauntlet of concerned parents at the door and out into the night. Dad, she cries, tugging back at him. And only then does he realize he's hurting her, clutching her hand like a lifeline in a swirl of darkening waters. I mean, have a cow, why don't you, she says, and he drops her hand. Sorry, I wasn't thinking. The flag is motionless now, hanging limp against the pole. He gazes up at the stars fixed in their tracks, cold and distant, and then the gravel crunches underfoot and they're in the parking lot. I just wanted a piece of cake, his daughter says. In the car, on the way home to her mother's house, she stares moodily out the window to let him feel the weight of her disappointment, but she can't sustain it. Before long, she's chattering away about Officer Rudman and Officer Torres, who sometimes helps with the program, telling him how nice they are and how corrupt the world is. We have gangs here, she says. Did you know that? Right here in our neighborhood. He gazes out on $500,000 homes, stone and stucco, mailboxes out front, basketball hoops over garage doors. The streets are deserted. He sees no gangs. Here? Uh-huh, Chrissy Mueller saw two guys in Raiders hats at the 7-Eleven the other day. Maybe they were buying ho-hos. Maybe they just wanted a piece of cake. Come on, Dad, she says, but her tone tells him all is forgiven. Her mother's house is lighted like an arena, porch lights, security lights, even the windows poking bright, gleaming holes in the fabric of the night. He leans over to kiss his daughter goodnight, the car vibrating beneath him. Dad? Yes? I just wanted to, you know, ask you, did you ever use drugs, or Mom? The question catches him by surprise. He looks beyond her, looks at that glowing, bright house a moment, curtains open wide, the wash of light on the lawn. Abstertion, epop, Eleusinian, the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. No, he says finally, no. Thank you very much. You're just a marvelous crowd. I'd like to take you all back on the airplane to Santa Barbara tomorrow, but you can only stay a week, okay? I had been planning on reading another story tonight from Tooth and Claw. It's a very dramatic, powerful story that makes you feel absolutely miserable. I read it in Miami on this tour, and one woman sobbed about midway through the story, sobbed through the whole thing. And I felt, Michael's going to say I'm funny, and, you know, why not celebrate being here, the beautiful weather, you know, the coming rainstorm. So I decided I'd read something entirely different, something that might be more fun, that we could have a good laugh over together, just for the pure fun of it. Okay. I haven't read this one for some time, and it requires some precision. So you'll have to forgive me. I'm going to try my best to do it. It's a story called Beat, and it exemplifies some of the way in which I work. Here I just read you a story that sprang from an experience I had. I went to this dare thing, and the rest is invented. What does it mean? What do I feel about it? In this case, this is another mode of storytelling. Almost a tall tale, but also a partly literary pastiche. It's my take on the Beats. Who are they? What do they do? And also a take on idol worship and what it can be. Now, this story is set at Christmas time in Long Island, where Jack Kerouac was living with his mother in his decline, very drunk, puffy, getting on, having problems. And it's narrated by a fellow, a young fan, who has run away from home and tried to join this Beat movement and come to visit him. All the elderly among us, we will know all the principal characters here, but for the young, and I mean people under 28, you will be introduced to the story not only to Jack Kerouac, but to the other figures of the Beat pantheon. That is William Burroughs, Allen Ginsberg, Neil Cassidy, and they all, in my imagination, for this particular Christmas, will be revealed here in this story when they come to visit Jack at the end of the Beat era. And you know what? I brought a prop along. Brought a prop for this one. Okay. Beat. Yeah, I was beat. We were all beat. Hell, I'm beat now. Is, was, and always will be. I mean, how do you stop? But this isn't about me. I'm nobody, really. Just window dressing on the whole mother of bop, freight train hopping, holy higher than Tokay Beat trip into the heart of the American night. No, what I want to tell you about is Jack and Neil and Alan and Bill and all the rest, too, and how it all went down, because I was there. I was on the scene, and there was nobody beater than me. Picture this. 17 years old, hair an unholy mess, and a little loden green beret perched up on the top to keep it in place, 83 cents in my pocket, and a finger-greased copy of The Subterraneans in my rucksack, along with a Charlie Parker disc with enough pop, scratches, and white noise worked into the grooves to fill out the soundtrack of a sci-fi flick hitched all the way from Oxnard, California. And there I am, on Jack's front porch in Northport, Long Island, December 23, 1958. It's cold. Bleak. The town full of paint-peeling old monster houses, gray and worn and just plain old, like the whole horse-blinded, tired, out East Coast, locked in its gloom from October to April with no time off for good behavior. I'm wearing three sweaters under my Levi's jacket, and still I'm holding on to my ribs, and I can feel the snot crusting around my nostrils, and these mittens I bummed from an old lady at the Omaha bus station are stiff with it, and I knock, wondering if there's an officially cool way to knock, a hipster's way, a kind of secret Dharma bum's code knock I don't know about. Knock, knock. Knock-a-da, knock-a-da. Knock, knock, knock. My first surprise was in store. It wasn't Jack, the gone, hip, Satori-seeking poet god of the rails and two-lane blacktop who answered the door, but a big, blocky old lady with a face like the bottom of a hiking boot. She was wearing a dress the size of something you could drape over a car to keep the dust off it, and it was composed of 1,000 little red and green triangles with gold trumpets and silver angels squeezed inside of them. She gave me the kind of look that could peel the tread off a recapped tire. The door held just ajar. I shuddered. She looked like somebody's mother. My own mother was 3,000 miles away and so square she was cubed. My dog, the one I'd had since childhood, was dead, flattened out by a big rig the week earlier, and I'd flunked English, history, calculus, art, phys ed, music, and lunch. I wanted adventure. The life of the road, freewheeling chicks and berets and tea and bongos and long benzedrine-inflected bullshit sessions that ran on into the morning. I wanted Jack and everything he stood for, and here was this old lady. I stammered, fighting to control my voice, which was just then deepening from the adolescent squeak I'd had to live with since consciousness had hit. Does Jack Kerouac live here? I mean, by any chance? Go back where you came from, the old lady said. My Jackie don't have time for no more of this nonsense. And that was it. She shut the door in my face. My Jackie. It came to me then. This was none other than Jack's mother, the bop-nurturing, freewheeling, wild Madonna herself, the woman who'd raised up the guru and given him form, mother of us all. And she'd locked me out. I'd come 3,000 miles. Her Jackie was my Jack. And I was cold through to the bone, stone broke, scared, heartsick, and just about a lungful of O2 away from throwing myself down in the slush and sobbing till somebody came out and shot me. I knocked again. Hey, Ma! I heard from some where deep inside the house, and it was like the running call of some dangerous beast, a muted, angry, threatening Bop, Benny, and Jug Wine roar, the voice of the man himself. What the hell is this? I'm trying to concentrate in here. And then the old lady. It ain't nothing, Jackie. Knock, knock, knock it, knock it, knock, knock, knock. I paradiddled that door, knocked it and socked it, beat on it like it was the bald, flat-top dome of my uptight, pencil-pushing drudge of a bourgeois father himself, or maybe Mr. Detwinder, the principal at Ocknard High. I knocked till my knuckles bled, a virtuoso of knocking, so caught up in the rhythm and energy of it that it took me a minute to realize the door was open and Jack himself standing there in the doorway. He looked the way Belmondo tried to look in Breathless, loose and cool in a rumpled T-shirt and jeans with a smoke in one hand, a bottle of Muscatel in the other. I stopped knocking. My mouth fell open and the snot froze in my nostrils. Jack Kerouac? I said. He let a grin slide down one side of his mouth and back up the other. Nobody else, he said. The wind shot down my collar. I caught a glimpse of colored lights blinking on and off in the room behind him, and suddenly it was all gushing out of me like something I'd been chewing over and digesting all my life. I hitched all the way from Oxnard, and my name's Wallace Pinto, but you can call me Buzz, and I just wanted to tell you. Yeah, I know, he said, waving a hand in dismissal. And he seemed unsteady on his Muscatel-impaired feet, the smoke curling up to snatch at his cracked blue squinting eyes, the words slow on his lips, heavy, weighted, and freighted with the deep, everlasting, bardic wisdom of the road, the cat house, and the seaman's bar. But I tell you, kid, you keep drumming on the door like that, you're going to end up in the hospital. A pause. Or maybe a jazz combo. I just stood there in a kind of trance until I felt his hand, his Dharma bum subterranean on the road bopmaster's gone Mexican chick digging hand, take hold of my shoulder and tug me forward over the threshold and into the house. You ever been introduced to a true and veritable set of tight-skinned bongos, he asked, throwing an arm over my shoulder as the door slammed behind us. 2 hours later, we were sitting there in the front room by this totally gone Christmas tree, bedecked with cherubim and little Christs and the like, indulging in a poor boy and a joint or two of Miss Green, my Charlie Parker record whizzing and popping on the record player, and a whole pile of red and green construction paper strips growing at our feet. We were making a chain to drape over the beatest tree you ever saw, and the music was a cool breeze fluttering full of yard bird breath, and the smell of ambrosia and manna crept in from the kitchen where Mamere, the beat Madonna herself, was cooking up some first-rate, mouth-watering, Canuck-style 2 days before Christmas chow. I hadn't eaten since New Jersey the morning before, and that was only some pretty piss-poor diner hash fries and a runny solitary egg, and I was cutting up little strips of colored paper and pasting them in little circles as Jack's chain grew and my head spun from the wine and the weed. That big old lady in the Christmas dress just kind of vanished. And the food appeared, and we ate, Jack and I, side by side, left our beat plates on the sofa, threw our chain on the tree, and we were just pouring through the coats in the front hallway for another poor boy of sweet Tokay wine when there was a knock at the door. This knock wasn't like my knock, not at all. This was a delicate knock, understated and minimalistic, but with a whole deep continent of passion and expectation implicit in it. In short, a feminine knock. Well, Jack said, his face lit with the beatest joy at discovering the slim vessel of a pint bottle in the inside pocket of his seaman's peacoat. Aren't you going to answer it? Me? I said, grinning my beatest grin. I was in. I was part of it all. I was Jack's confidant and compatriot, and we were in the front hallway of his pad in Northport, Long Island, a fine, hot, steaming mother of Jack prepared meal in our gone beet guts, and he was asking me to answer the door. Me, 17 years old and nobody. You mean it? And my grin widened till I could feel the creeping, seeping East Coast chill all the way back to my suburban dentist-filled molars. Jack, uncapping, tipping back, passing the bottle. That's a chick knock, Buzz. Me. I love chicks. Jack, a gone, lovely spring flower of a beret-wearing, flipped, long-legged, coltish, retroussé nose and run away from home to Big Jack Kerouac chick knock. Me. I am crazy. For gone lovely spring flower beret wearing flip long-legged cultures retroussé nose runaway from home the Big Jack Kerouac chicks. Jack, then answer it. I pulled open the door, and there she was, all the above and more, 16 years old with big undulate eyes and Mary Travers hair. She gave me a gaping, open-mouthed look, taking in my loden-green beret, the frizzed wildness of my hair sticking out from under it, my beat Levi's jacket and jeans, and my tea-red and joyous hitching all the way from Oxnard eyes. I was looking for Jack, she said, and her voice was cracked and scratchy and low. She dropped her gaze. I looked at Jack, who stood behind me out of her line of vision, and asked a question with my eyebrows. Jack gave me his hooded, smoldering dust jacket from hell look, then stepped forward, took the poor boy from me, and loomed over the now eye-lifting chick and chucked her chin with a gone-beat curling index finger. "Coochie-coochie-coo," he said. Her name was Ricky Keene, Ricarda Kinkowski, actually, but that's how she introduced herself. She'd hitchhiked all the way down from Plattsburgh, and she was as full of hero worship and inarticulate praise as I was. "Dean Moriarty," she said at the end of a long, rambling speech that alluded to nearly every line Jack had written and half the Zoot Sims catalog. "He's the coolest. I mean, that's who I want to make babies with, absolutely." There we were, standing in the front hallway, listening to this crack-voiced, undulant-eyed, long-gone, beet-haired, 16-year-old chick talk about making babies with Charlie Parker riffing in the background and the Christmas lights winking on and off, and it was strange and poignant. All I could say was, "Wow," over and over. But Jack knew what to do. He threw one arm over my shoulder and the other over the chick's, and he thrust his already bloating and booze-inflamed but quintessentially beat face into ours and said, low and rumbly, "What we need, the three of us hepsters, cats and chicks alike, is a consciousness-raising all-night bull session at the indubitable pinnacle of all neighborhood bodhisattva centers and bars and grills, the Peroration Pub, or as the fellaheen know it, Ziggy's Clam House. What do you say?" What did we say? We were speechless, stunned, amazed, moved almost to tears. The man himself, he who had practically invented the mug, the jug, and the highball and lifted the art of getting sloshed to its beat apotheosis, was asking us, the skinny, underage, bedraggled runaways, to go out on the town for a night of wild and prodigious Kerouacian drinking. All I could manage was a nod of assent. Ricky Keene said, "Yeah, sure, like, wow." And then we were out in the frozen rain, the three of us, the streets all crusted with ugly East Coast ice, Ricky on one side of Jack, me on the other, Jack's arms uniting us. We tasted freedom on those frozen streets, passing the bottle, our minds elevated and feverish with the fat spike of Mary Jane that appeared magically between Jack's thumb and forefinger and the little strips of Benzedrine-soaked felt he made us swallow like a sacrament. The wind sang a dirge. Ice clattered down out of the sky. We didn't care. We walked 8 blocks, our beat jackets open to the elements, and we didn't feel a thing. I woke the next afternoon on the sofa in the living room of the pad Jack shared with his mamere. The sofa was grueling terrain, pocked and scoured by random dips and high, hard, draft-buffeted plateaus, but my stringy, impervious 17-year-old form had become one with it in a way that approached bliss. It was, after all, a sofa, and not the cramped front seat of an A&P produce truck or road-hopping Dodge, and it had the rugged, book-thumbing, late-night crashing, bongo-thumping, joint-rolling aura of Jack to recommend and sanctify it. So what if my head was as big as a weather balloon and the rest of me felt like so many pounds and ounces of beef jerky? So what if I was nauseated from cheap wine and tea and Benzedrine and my tongue was stuck like Velcro to the roof of my mouth and Ricky Keene was snoring on the floor instead of sharing the sofa with me? So what if Bing Crosby and Mario Lanza were blaring square Christmas carols from the radio in the kitchen and Jack's big hunkering soul of a mother maneuvered her shouldery bulk into the room every 5 seconds to give me a look of radiant hatred and motherly impatience? So what? I was at Jack's, nirvana attained. When finally I threw back the odd, fuzzy, Canuck-knitted, detergent-smelling, fully beat Afghan some kind soul Jack had draped over me in the dim hours of the early morning, I became aware that Ricky and I were not alone in the room. A stranger was fixed like a totem pole in the armchair across from me, a skinny, rangy, long-nosed, Brahmin-looking character with a 100-mile stare and a dull brown beat suit that might have come off the back of an insurance salesman from Hartford, Connecticut. He barely breathed, squinting glassy-eyed into some dark, unfathomable vision, like a man trying to see his way to the end of a tunnel, as lizard-like a human being as I've ever seen. And who could this be, I wondered, perched here rigid-backed in Jack's gone-beat pad on the day before Christmas and communing with a whole other reality? Ricky Keene snored lightly from her nest on the floor. I studied the man in the chair like he was a science project or something until all at once it hit me. This was none other than Bill himself, the marksman, freighted all the way across the beat, heaving blue cold Atlantic from Tangier to wish Jack and his beat Madonna a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. "Bill," I cried, leaping up from the sofa to pump his dead wooden hand. I can't tell you what an honor. And I went on in that gone worshipful vein for what must have been 10 minutes. Some vestige of the Benzedrine come up on me suddenly. And Ricky Keene snapped open her pure golden eyes like two pats of butter melting into a pile of pancakes, and I knew I was hungry and transported and headachy, and Bill never blinked an eye or uttered a word. "Who's that?" Ricky Keene breathed in her scratchy, crack-throat, cancery rasp that I'd begun to find incredibly sexy. "Who's that?" I echoed in disbelief. "Why, it's Bill." Ricky Keene stretched, yawned, readjusted her beret. "Who's Bill?" "You mean you don't know who Bill is?" I yelped. And all the while, Bill sat there like a corpse, his irises drying out and his lips clamped tight round the little nugget of his mouth. Ricky Keene ignored the question. "Did we eat anything last night?" she rasped. "I'm so hungry I could puke." At that moment, I became aware of a sharp, gland-stimulating, gone-wild smell wafting in from the kitchen on the very same beat airwaves that carried the corny vocalizations of Bing and Mario. Somebody was making flapjacks. Now, despite our deep soul brother and sisterhood with Jack and his mamere, Ricky and I were nonetheless a little sketchy about just bursting into the kitchen and ingratiating our way into a plate of those flapjacks. So we paused to knock on the hinge-swinging slab of the kitchen door. There was no response. We heard Mario Lanza, the sizzle of grease in the pan, and voices talking or chanting. One of them seemed to be Jack's, so we knocked again and boldly pushed open the door. If there was a climax to all that had come before, a beat epiphany and wholly epitomized moment, this was it. Jack was there at the kitchen table and his mother at the stove, yes, but there was a third person present, arrived among us like one of the bearded mystics out of the East. And who could it be with his mad, calculating, bug-eyed, big-lipped look of Zen wisdom and frog-like beauty? I knew in an instant. It was Alan. Alan himself, the poet laureate of beatdom, come all the way from Paris for this far-out moment with Jack and his mother in their humble little beat kitchen on the cold north shore of Long Island. He was sitting at the table with Jack, spinning a dreidel and singing in a muddy, moist, sweet wine-lubricated voice. "Dreidel, dreidel, dreidel, I made it out of clay, and when it's dry and ready, then dreidel I will play." Jack waved Ricky and me into the room and pushed us down into two empty chairs at the kitchen table. "Flipped," he murmured as the dreidel spun across the tabletop, and he poured us each a water glass of sticky Mogan David Blackberry wine, and my throat seized at the taste of it. "Drink up, man, it's Christmas," Jack shouted, thumping my back to jolt open the tubes. That was when Mamere came into the picture. She was steaming about something, really livid, her shoulders all hunched up and her face stamped with red-hot, broiling, uncontainable rage. But she served the flapjacks, and we ate in beat communion, fork-grabbing, syrup-pouring, and butter-smearing, while Alan rhapsodized about the inner path and Jack poured more wine. In retrospect, I should have been maybe a hair more attuned to Jack's mother and her moods, but I shoved flapjacks into my face, reveled in beat them, and ignored the piercing glances and rattling pans. Afterward, we left our beat plates where we dropped them and rushed into the living room to spin some sides and pound on the bongos while Alan danced a disheveled dance and blew into the wooden flute and Bill looked down the long tunnel of himself. What can I say? The legends were gathered. We cut up the Benzedrine inhalers and swallowed the little supercharged strips of felt inside, feasted on Miss Green, and took a gone beat hike to the liquor store for more wine and still more. By dark, I was able to feel the wings of consciousness lift off my back, and my memory of what came next is glorious, but hazy. At some point, 8, 9, I was aroused from my 17-year-old apprentice beat stupor by the sound of sniffling and choke-back sobs, and found myself looking up at the naked but for a seaman's peacoat form of Ricky Keene. I seemed to be on the floor behind the couch, buried in a litter of doilies, antimacassars, and sheets of crumpled newspaper, the lights from the Christmas tree riding up the walls, and Ricky Keene standing over me with her bare legs, heaving out chesty sobs and using the ends of her long-gone hair to dab at the puddles of her eyes. "What?" I said. "What is it?" She swayed back and forth, rocking on her naked feet, and I couldn't help admiring her knees and the way her bare young hitchhiking thighs sprouted upward from them to disappear in the folds of the coat. "It's Jack," she sobbed, the sweet rasp of her voice catching in her throat, and then she was behind the couch and kneeling like a supplicant over the jean-clad poles of my outstretched legs. "Jack?" I repeated stupidly. A moment of silence, deep and committed. There were no corny carols seeping in from the radio in the kitchen, no wild tooth-bearing jazz or Indian sutras roaring from the record player. There was no Alan, no Jack, no Mamere. If I'd been capable of sitting up and thrusting my head over the back of the sofa, I would have seen that the room was deserted, but for Bill, still locked in his comatose reverie. Ricky Keene sat on my knees. "Jack won't have me," she said, in a voice so tiny I was hardly aware she was speaking at all. And then, with a pout, "He's drunk." Jack wouldn't have her. I mulled fuzzily over this information, making slow, drawn-out, turtle-like connections, while Ricky Keene sat on my knees with her golden eyes and Mary Travers' hair. And finally I said to myself, if Jack won't have her, then who will? I didn't have a whole lot of experience along these lines. My adventures with the opposite sex had been limited to lingering, dumbstruck classroom gazes and the odd double-feature grope. But I was willing to learn. And eager. Oh, yes. "It's such a drag being a virgin," she breathed, unbuttoning the coat. And I sat up and took hold of her, clamped my panting, perspiring, sex-crazed adolescent self to her, actually. And we kissed and throbbed and explored each other's anatomies in a drifting cloud of beat bliss and gone holy rapture. I was lying there, much later, tingling with the quiet rush and thrill of it all, Ricky breathing softly into the cradle of my right arm, when suddenly the front door flew back and the world's wildest, heppest, Benny-crazed, coast-to-coasting voice lit the room like a brush fire. I sat up, groped for my pants, cradled a startled Ricky head. "Ho, ho, ho," the voice boomed. "All you little boysies and girls, he's been good. I've been checking my list." I popped my head over the couch and there he was, cool and inexplicable. I couldn't believe my eyes. It was Neil. Neil escaped from San Quentin and dressed in a street corner Santa outfit, a bag full of booze, drugs, cigarettes, and canned hams slung over his back, his palms hammering invisible bongos in the air. Come out, wherever you are," he cried, and broke down in a sea of giggles. "Gonna find out who's naughty and nice. Oh, yes, indeed." At that moment, Jack burst in from the kitchen where he and Alan had been taking a little catnap over a jug of wine, and that was when the really wild times began, the back-thumping, high-fiving, jumping, jiving, tea-smoking, scat-singing beat revel of the ages. Ricky Keene came to life with a snort, wrapped the jacket round her, and stepped out from behind the couch like a beat princess. I reached for the wine, Jack howled like a dog, and even Bill shifted his eyes round his head in a simulacrum of animacy. Neil couldn't stop drinking and talking and smoking, spinning round the room like a dervish. Alan shouted, "Miles Davis!" And the record player came to life, and we were all dancing, even Bill, though he never left the chair. That was the crowning moment of my life. I was beat, finally and absolutely, and I wanted it to go on forever. And it could have, if it wasn't for Jack's mother. That square-shouldered, fuming old woman in the Christmas dress. She was nowhere to be seen through all of this, and I'd forgotten about her in the crazed explosion of the moment. It wasn't until Jack began to break down that she materialized again. It was around 12 or so. Jack got a little weepy, sang an a cappella version of Hark the Herald Angels Sing, and tried to talk us all into going to the midnight mass at St. Columbanus' church. Alan said he had no objection, except that he was Jewish. Neil derided the whole thing as the height of corny bourgeois sentimentality. Bill was having trouble moving his lips. And Ricky Keene said that she was Unitarian and didn't know if she could handle it. Jack, tears streaming down his face, turned to me. "Buzz," he said, and he had this wheedling, crazed, biggest thing in the world sort of edge to his voice. "Buzz, you're a good Catholic. I know you are. What do you say?" All eyes focused on me. Silence rang suddenly through the house. I was three sheets to the wind, sloppy, drunk, 17 years old. Jack wanted to go to midnight mass, and it was up to me to say yay or nay. I just stood there, wondering how I was going to break the news to Jack that I was an atheist and that I hated God, Jesus, and my mother, who made me go to parochial school 5 days a week since I'd learned to walk and religious instruction on Sundays to boot. My mouth moved, but nothing came out. Jack was trembling. A tick started in over his right eye. He clenched his fists. "Don't let me down, Buzz," he roared. And when he started toward me, Neil tried to stop him, but Jack flung him away as if he was nothing. "Midnight mass, Buzz, midnight," he boomed. And he was standing right there in front of me, gone beat crazy, and I could smell the booze on his stinking beat breath. He dropped his voice then. "You'll rot in hell, Buzz," he hissed. "You'll rot." Alan reached for his arm, but Jack shook him off. I took a step back. That was when Mamère appeared. She swept into the room like something out of a Japanese monster flick, huge in her nightdress, big old Jack mothery toes sticking out beneath it like sausages, and she went straight to the fireplace and snatched up the poker. "Out!" she screamed, the eyes sunk back in her head. "Get out of my house, you queers and convicts and drug addicts, and you!" she turned on me and Ricky. "You so-called fans and adulators, you're even worse. Go back where you came from and leave my Jackie in peace." She made as if to swing the poker at me, and I reflexively ducked out of the way, but she brought it down across the lamp on the table instead. There was a flash. The lamp exploded, and she drew back and whipped the poker like a lariat over her head. "Out!" she shrieked, and the whole group, even Bill, edged toward the door. Jack did nothing to stop her. He gave us his brooding lumberjack beat posing on the fire escape look, but there was something else to it, something new. And as I backpedaled out the door and into the grimy, raw East Coast night, I saw what it was. The look of a mama's boy, pouty and spoiled. "Go home to your mothers, all of you," Mamere yelled, shaking the poker at us as we stood there, drop-jawed on the dead brown ice-covered pelt of the lawn. "For God's sake," she sobbed, "it's Christmas." And then the door slammed shut. I was in shock. I looked at Bill, Alan, Neil, and they were as stunned as I was. And poor Ricky. All she had on was Jack's peacoat, and I could see her tiny, bare, perfect-toed beet-chick feet freezing to the ground like twin ice sculptures. I reached up to adjust my beret and realized it wasn't there. And it was like I just had the wind knocked out of me. "Jack!" I cried out suddenly in my creaking adolescent voice, turned it into a forlorn bleat. "Jack!" I cried. "Jack!" But the night closed round us, and there was no answer. What happened from there is a long story, but to make it short, I took Mamere's advice and went home to my mother, and by the time I got there, Ricky had already missed her period. My mother didn't like it, but the two of us moved into my boyhood room with the lame college pennants and dinosaur posters and whatnot on the walls for about a month, which is all we could stand, and then Ricky took her gone, gorgeous, beat Madonna of the streets little body off to an ultra-beat one-room pad on the other end of town, and I got a job as a brakeman on the Southern Pacific, and she let me crash with her, and that was that. We smoked tea and burned candles and incense and drank jug wine and made it till we damn near rubbed the skin off each other. The first four boys we named Jack, Neil, Alan, and Bill, though we never... Though we never saw any of their namesakes again, except Alan at one of his poetry readings, and he made like he didn't know us. The first of the girls we named Gabrielle for Jack's mother, and after that we seemed to kind of just lose track and name them for the month they were born, regardless of sex, and so we wound up with two Junes, June the male and June the female. But it was no big thing. Yeah, I was beat. Beater than any of them, or just as beat anyway. Looking back on it now, though, I mean, after all these years, and what with the mortgage payments, and Ricky's detox, and the kids with their college tuition, and the way the woodworking shop over the garage burned down, and how stinking, close-fisted, petty bourgeois before the revolution, pig-headed, cheap, the railroad disability is, I wonder now if I'm not so much beat anymore as just plain beat. But then, I couldn't even begin to find the words to describe it to you. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
Tom Boyle has told me, in fact, that he loves his fans, and you just heard a story about fanhood. So he tells me that when fans bring up all his books, he tends to...
Well, let me get my pen out, Michael.
to sign them all. And, you know, at the end of the reading, he'll be doing so in the lobby. Okay.
Well, what about the foreign editions?
Only the collectors have them, but there'll be some here, I'm sure. Okay. When you started out, you were doing those hilarious stories. That story is 17 years old, and I think it's still fresh.
Actually, that story, I think, is from 93.
93, 13 years old?
What's the math, yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't do math. You know, I'm one of those literary people. I barely went to high school. But, well, some days. But I wondered, you moved from that kind of parody and Mad Magazine kind of spirited humor to something much wider. And I wondered what it was like to sort of threaten your audience with the death of humor.
Well, I wouldn't go so far as that, Michael. There are very funny stories in the new collection. I think the aforementioned sex book is hilarious, because, of course, sex is hilarious to begin with. No, I don't abandon anything. I like to try everything I possibly can. I've just written a bunch of new stories after this novel, Talk Talk, that feature
female protagonists. I don't know exactly why, simply maybe because I haven't done so much of that. I'm always looking for something new.
How do you... I never asked this, but you seem to be such a productive writer, doing at least a new book a year and usually publishing simultaneously.
My wife is
stories.
A shopper. That's it. That's the key and to it right there. Otherwise, if I miss a book one year, you see me sitting out front of the theater rattling change in a cup.
You read to your wife every morning. Is that true?
I read to her in the afternoon when I'm done with work, and not so that she will say, oh, geez, you got to change that. Just so I can hear how it goes, and she can give me an opinion if she wants. But she knits, and I read. And I love to hear the rhythm of it. Now, this last story, obviously, is an exemplar of rhythmic prose. But I think in all the stories, there's a rhythm that's very important to me. I always work with music playing, for instance. This past week, I was in Los Angeles in the studio doing an unabridged recording of Talk Talk, the new novel. Why am I doing this? Well, I'll tell you. I had done some recordings of my books in the late 80s, early 90s, but it takes a lot of time and it's a real bother, so I didn't do it. And I'm a huge fan of books on tape, and I was listening last year to Carol Shields read Larry's Party, brilliant novel, brilliant reading by the author. Carol has passed on. Now I'm okay, I'm all right, I'm feeling fine, you know. But I still felt that it would be almost a duty to get my voice down for whoever cares, whoever's interested. And so I spent 3.5 days in the studio working with the same people, by the way, with whom I recorded Tooth and Claw last year. And it is such an amazing experience to be in the studio by yourself emoting, and it's overwhelmingly emotional. I don't know what there is about it. And yet, also, I couldn't stop moving my hands the whole time. There's a kind of conducting. It's like you're conducting the rhythm, and that's when you really hear the rhythm of the sentences.
I want to mention to the people here, there is a movement. When I think books on tape is okay, it's a question people always ask me. It's an okay idea, but I love hearing it when the author reads. And there are two sets of books on tape that I do want to tell you about because they came from our beloved foundation. One of them is the trilogy, Beckett's trilogy, Malloy, Malone Dies, and the Unnameable, read by a great Beckett actor. All of it together and listening to it is just overwhelming. And the second, actually, the author, William Gass, reading all of The Tunnel, every single page, and it's astonishing.
And it only took him 12 years to read it.
And it took him around 24 years to write it.
You know, it's curious what you say about books on tape. Some years ago, I was in Japan on a book tour, and people were coming to hear me, spoke English, obviously, because I'm not speaking in Japanese. And one day, I was reading a story, and I knew enough to read a story that wasn't overtly comic, so, you know, it would be like a comedian telling a joke and no one laughs. I knew that the Japanese might be loving it, but they're not going to laugh aloud in public. That's just not going to happen. And I was reading a rather intense story called King Bee. And it's about this. A couple is sort of seduced. They want to adopt a child. And they're sort of seduced into it by a sleazy guy who gives them an older child. It's a 9-year-old kid. He's big for his age. And he's mentally disturbed. And it turns out that he threatens them, and it becomes a very grim kind of thing. But his only obsession is with bees. He loves bees. This is what he lives for. This is what he identifies with. And the first question from the audience was, Professor Boyle, what is this bee? And I felt that this man probably didn't get the whole story. The second question was not a question so much as a statement. And it was from a woman who raised her hand and said, you know, I don't like hearing your voice because now, whenever I read your books, I will hear your voice instead of that tiny little voice in my own head. And as tenderly as I could, I said to her, well, madam, maybe you shouldn't go to any more readings. But that is, of course, a problem with books on tape. You are hearing someone else's version. I've had the privilege on several occasions of being an actor in performances of my own stories by actors. It's Isaiah Schaefer's Selected Shorts is the first and best of these programs. But we have one in Santa Barbara in a beautiful theater like this, the Libero. And for the last 2 years, and coming up soon, they will do a show devoted to my stories with four actors reading different stories, and then I will read a story. And it's thrilling for me to sit in the audience and listen to the actors because they're giving a version that is not exactly my version, but it's great because, you know, I wrote the song and they're singing the song. It's thrilling.
Now, I want you to tell a true story, if you will, one that I've always been curious about. I read that it was never your intention to be a writer. It came late. It came after you'd studied music in a small college, and that you just started and published a story in a literary magazine. Was it North American Review?
North American Review, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, Iowa, which is probably the most venerable of the writing programs in America, is famous for accepting its writers not on the basis of their academic records, but on the basis
Thank
of their
God.
Writing. Yeah. But you seem to have arrived and dove instantly into a discipline of writing, which seems to contradict the reputation of the anarchic drug craze.
Yes, okay. There are many things in this question, Michael.
Yes,
and
yes.
I'll take some of them up. We talked earlier about maturity. You know, I was just a disaffected, crazy kid. I mean, you look at this elegant man before you, I know it's hard to believe, but I was. And I've been in school since I was 4 and a half, and I was a slow learner, and I was causing problems, and so on and so on. A nice boy, but, you know, I just didn't like school very much. By the way, the irony is I've been in school my entire life. I wanted to be a musician. I played saxophone and clarinet. I went to the music school and flunked my audition. I just didn't have a sense of what it was supposed to be. Meanwhile, though, I had to declare a major, and there was history. So I'd always loved history, as you can see from my novels. And I declared myself a history major and found a mentor there, Dr. Vincent Knapp, a brilliant and wonderful man who took me under his wing. But then I had to take an English course, and I was introduced to the contemporary short story, including stories by Flannery O'Connor, in particular, A Good Man is Hard to Find and Good Country People, which revolutionized my outlook on life. You can be funny and tragic at the same time. So I declared a double major, history and English. Junior year, I walked into a creative writing class. And I'll tell you that story, if you'd like to hear it.
Yes.
Now we're very sophisticated with regard to creative writing. I teach at USC. I've been teaching there ever since I left Iowa. I'm devoted to undergrad education because I was able to find what I wanted to do by going through all these various courses. But in those days, it was fairly rudimentary. Our professor was Krishna Vaad. Krishna was a Hindu who was Harvard-educated, PhD, under the spell of James Joyce in particular. He wrote novels in Hindi and translated them himself into English. He was brilliant. He was amazing. We worshipped him. However, he wasn't very communicative in class. And here is the way the class went. There were 11 poets who wrote incomprehensible gibberish, and me. One of those poets, incidentally, had a reincarnated Egyptian princess and had a tattoo on her ankle to prove that. At any rate, the format of the class was they would read their poems and then we were expected to comment on them. We hadn't read them beforehand, they just read them, and, you know. And Krishna never said very much one way or the other, you know, he left it to us. So finally, after a few weeks, he said to me, well, Tom, you know, why don't you put something up for next week? At the time, we were reading in another class The Absurdist Playwrights, who, as you could imagine, had great appeal for me. And I decided I would write a play, a one-act play. And the play was called The Foot. And as the curtain opens, there is a bereaved couple sitting there with a little coffee table and with flowers. And in the middle of this wreath of flowers is a little kid's tennis shoe with a bloody little sock and a stump of the little kid's foot. And their child has just been entirely eaten by an alligator, except for the foot, which they yanked out of its mouth. So I read this story. I read this play. And Krishna, the rock, who had never shown any emotion, began to chuckle. And so, of course, the poets reluctantly chuckled, too, to curry favor with him. And then, finally, at the end, he was laughing aloud, and he applauded. And I thought, wow, this is my gig. So you see the beauty of the undergraduate liberal arts education. I mean, this is just a great thing.
Now, you get to Iowa, and as I understand it from... I mean, I probably have known at least one writer in Iowa for every year for the last 20 years. And they get there and they get completely wigged out because everyone else there, it seems, already knows how to write and they're turning out 20 to 40 pages a week. And they feel, I've never done that before. What did you do with the competition and working into the...
I think we'd all like to think that artists are non-competitive and they love one another and it's a community effort. But in fact, we despise each other and we want to kill. And by the way, I walk around like all of you and I don't have deep thoughts unless I'm writing. My thoughts are essentially kill, screw, eat all day long. And so I write short stories in order to figure out, you know, what life means. At any rate, I protected myself in a couple of ways. For one thing, I'd already published by the time I got there. And I was very devoted to the short story and working in that form. At the same time, however, the very first day I got there, irrespective of your undergraduate record, you could take PhD courses if you wanted to. So I began taking PhD courses. And as it turned out, I was able to distance myself from all the gossip and the backbiting and the hatreds and the feuds and the meltdowns and, you know, the chairs on fire and the, you know, the whole thing. Because the writers would say to me, oh, come on, man, you got to do this or that. And I would say, no, look, I'm a scholar. I can't do that. And vice versa. The scholars would say, oh, let's go do this. I'd say, no, I can't do that. I'm a writer. And so I was able to stay away from all of that and not to make too many enemies.
I want to point out, the writer you'll be hearing next week, if you're wise, Stuart Dybeck, was in the same class in Iowa as T.C. Boyle. And T.C. Boyle's daughter was in the same class as Stuart Dybeck's son at Iowa.
That's wonderful.
There's a whole tradition that goes on here.
And when you mentioned this morning, I said, and of course the grandchildren will be there.
but I think it's interesting to think of two such different writers coming from the same program. Mm. How did you treat one another, using that as a case in point?
The rap against writing programs is something I don't understand. I think it's mainly from people who don't have any experience of them. It is that you write for the class and you try to write a certain kind of story, but I've never seen that. There are no rules, of course. You do what you like. You're an artist. And by the time you get there, it's like going to Juilliard, you know? You're going to practice your instrument and you're going to make it better. All modes and styles are accepted, without exception. You can do whatever you like.
Now, you said just before that you write a story to find out the meaning of life.
Well, I haven't found that out yet, but I'm hoping.
I was wondering, yeah.
I'm really hoping, yes.
And also, you famously said that Flannery O'Connor, for all of the darkness and brutal hilarity of her stuff, at least had faith to go on, and that you don't. How do you continue in its absence, since it was so important to her?
I have a simple equation with people, and in entire countries, for that matter. If you love me, I love you. And I love Laurie Moore. Laurie Moore said in a review of one of my books that I am like Flannery O'Connor, only with no God and TV. And it's a perceptive comment because, I'm of the TV generation. Grew up with TV instead of books. It wasn't until I went to college and became a TV virgin, incidentally, that I discovered that there's another world out there. As far as trying to find some kind of meaning, that is what I write for, to impose my own order on chaos. And truly, we would like to think of writers, Dostoevsky, for instance, brooding and thinking deep thoughts, but I really don't believe that he did unless he was writing. It's the focus of writing, the opening of the mind to the unconscious that allows you to make art, to make these things happen. Any story that you will hear of mine, I never know what it will be. It may seem well-formed to you, and it seems logical that this is where it should go, and you can go back to the story and see what it means and what the themes are and how it builds from the first sentence. But truly, even with novels, I don't know. It's an exploration. I have a voice talking, and I follow it. Now, it's not to say that it's easy. There are many periods of being very distraught and suicidal because it's not working. But sometimes it does, and you have faith that it's worked before, it may work again.
Around, oh, I guess 6 years in reading you, I discovered, I confess to my horror, that you were actually a moral writer.
Yes. Oh, this is hilarious. My books of stories came out, I think, like after the plague came out, and I got a bunch of reviews, and I only read the good ones, by the way, folks. And one person said, here is Boyle on his moral high horse again. And the next one that I read said, this man is amoral and, you know, and should be sent to the penitentiary, you know? So I think that's for the reader to decide. I don't think that it's the artist's job to impose any kind of morality or political stance or anything else on the audience. The audience is there to be invited into a work of art, to interpret it and enjoy it as they will in their own individual way. I think the art has to be free-flowing and express what it will uniquely to that story or that novel. That said, if you know my work, I think you pretty much know what I stand for in terms of politics and the environment and all the rest of it. Certainly, but it's nothing I would want to impose on anyone.
You don't seem to have had, the way many short story writers have, and Carver had all his life, that fear of the novel. In fact, after that first book of stories came out, out came Water Music, a big novel. Mm. Do you have any idea of where that facility came from? You didn't seem ever to suffer from a lack of confidence.
Some writers, and I know many of them, of course, and have had many students over the years, are naturally suited to the short form, some only to the long form. Two of my teachers at Iowa, Vance Bergeli and then his student, John Irving, worked in the long form. They don't write short stories. They don't think that way. John Cheever, another of my teachers there,
wow,
was pretty much the opposite.
Wow, you had Bergeli and Cheever. People have forgotten Bergeli, but he's a real surprise.
He is a superb writer.
Yeah.
And a very encouraging teacher. All three of them were. Not so much that they taught or knew really what to do, but they just were saying to us, to some of us anyway, go for it, kid. You're doing very well, and we like what you're doing. But I've lost the train
but
of that
the,
long question.
Novel and stories.
Oh, yeah, novels and stories. So at that time, Ray Carver was living in town. He had graduated some years before, but he was back in town just hanging out. In fact, he and John Cheever would go down to the mill every day and lay out their cigarettes and get their cocktails and spend the day, you know. I'd love to have a recording of whatever they talked about, but I was just a student and I don't know. At any rate, I said to John Irving that I was content to be a short story writer, and like Ray, and I would just write stories. And he said, well, you might change your mind. And once I had finished my PhD, I did feel the challenge of doing something larger. I was halfway through with Water Music when my agent sold my first book of stories to Little Brown, Atlantic Little Brown. And they asked me, well, do you have a novel? And I lied and said no, because I wanted the stories to come out first. Subsequently, by the way, Penguin bought the rights and have kept all my books in print ever since. And I've been with Viking for hardcover and Penguin ever after, and I'm very happy about that.
I'm sort of reeling from the revelation that Carver was in town. That starts to sound like Christmas at Jack Kerouac's.
He was in town. He was in town twice. He was in town first, just hanging out. And they wouldn't give him a job because he wasn't famous yet. We students knew how brilliant he was. We'd read all his stories in the magazines, but Will You Please Be Quiet, Please hadn't come out yet. Second time he came to town, he taught. But I had 5.5 years there rather than just two because I stayed on for the PhD. So I knew writers of several classes and got to know Ray as well in two different periods.
Now, I'm going to jump cut. There's a certain thing that used to happen at the New Yorker, which was that, you know, if you weren't there from the day you started writing short stories, it used to be very, very hard to get in. And in after the plague,
there were 10 stories, or 9 or 10, that had appeared in The New Yorker. Was that a huge event for you, getting into The New Yorker?
Well, Ray is an exemplar of that. He was the best story writer of his time, and The New Yorker didn't pick up on it until very late in his career. I think it's just a question of who the editor is and what the editor wants. For those of you who are writers, and I got a look at the audience earlier, and I'd say about 98% of you are writers, isn't that correct? you have to persist in have faith in yourself, persist in sending stories out, because you're trying to match up a story with a given taste. And sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. If a magazine keeps rejecting you, well, perhaps, wait for the editor to die. And they do die. They do die off. And you get new editors. In the case of The New Yorker, once Tina Brown took over and Bill Buford came in as fiction editor, they were more receptive to, I think, non-traditional sorts of stories. Prior to that, and The New Yorker is a great magazine, which I love and I've always loved, but prior to that, I think the stories were more circumscribed. So it was simply a change of editorship.
Now, you talk about non-traditional kinds of short stories, but I think of you as having a better knowledge of a story's structure than most writers practicing. And I know, from knowing some of them, that you teach your students the structure of a short story and the incremental build.
Well, I don't teach them. They discover. They discover on their own. One thing I did a few years back was create my own text. It's called Double Takes. It's out from Thompson. And I took 30 writers whom I admire, contemporary writers. I did include a few like Cheever and O'Connor, but mainly writers of the 80s, 90s, and aughts. And I gave an example of two for each and wrote the headliners, head notes myself, so that instead of being very impersonal, it is, I feel this or I feel that. And I can use those stories in almost a prescriptive way. I can match them up with a given student. They're very various in their effects and how they tell stories. I included Roald Dahl's stories here, even though they're out of fashion, but he writes a beautiful kind of story that has a surprise ending. How do you get there? It's not so much that I would teach it or diagram it or anything like that. I would never do that. I would simply say, have you read this? And of course, then they would, when they do read it, they will write about it. And in writing about it, I think they are able to analyze it and perhaps take some of that analytical skill and apply it to their own inchoate fictions.
The place I was trying to go was the idea that however unconventional a story may be, that it still does have a structure.
Of course it does, and it has an entertainment value. I've often been misunderstood because of making such pronouncements, but I feel that all art is entertainment and it doesn't exist if it doesn't entertain. Now, that entertainment can be on many, many levels. The story that I was going to inflict on you tonight is entertainment too, but of a very different sort of what we heard tonight. I'm very conscious of that, always have been. That's the bottom line of my aesthetic. That and the use of the language and the beauty of the language. Structure is something innate. Each artist has a different value and a different gift, and I think we play to our strengths and not so much to our weaknesses. I think great artists try to challenge the weaknesses and grow and become more multidimensional. But structure is something that is just innate. Again, I don't know where any story will go or what it will be, but there's something in the process of it. For instance, the story Beat. So I was thinking about the beats and adulation that you give to a guru, what does it mean? What is it? So I read up about them, reread some of their stuff, and just jammed up this story. I have no idea why or where it was going or anything else. But you can see the initial idea is the fun of the language in this story. There are just many different approaches to a story. If the structure comes together, that's a kind of miracle. That's why I do it. There's an essay on my website, tcboyle.com, and if you go to About the Author at the bottom of the page, it's called This Monkey, My Back. I wrote it for Frank Conroy, who had asked for people from the workshop to write about their origins and their experience of the workshop. And I realized that it answers a lot of the questions I get from audiences about how I began. And by the way, I tell the story of the of Krishnavad and the reincarnated Egyptian princess. But I liken this rush of creation to a kind of drug high. Once you put yourself out there, you don't know whether it will work. And when it does, when you see what the ending will be and it comes together, there's no feeling quite like that. It's ecstasy. It's a kind of ecstasy that you are involved in. And immediately you want to feel it again and again and again. For example, when I finished East is East, I happened to be up on my mountain in the Sierra Nevadas, in the Sequoia Forest, where I go for peace and tranquility and to be really bored so I can work harder. And it happened that summer vacation was over, and my wife and children went down the mountain. I didn't have to teach that fall for some reason, and I stayed up frantically working to finish this, because when you get toward the end, you're just filled with joy all the time. I finished it, and I was triumphant. I spent the whole day, the next day, what can I do? I just finished the novel. I spent the whole day like a child in the woods. I was out at 9 o'clock reading a book on this rock miles out in the woods. Birds were perching on my shoulders. I was calling the squirrels by name. It was a joy. I stayed away from the bar until 5 o'clock. And the next day, I was so bored, I began a new story. Because you want this rush, not only of completion, but also of having some vision or gift that enables you to see things and make them concrete. And you can't waste it. You have to do it. It's a compulsion. And again, another joke is, I do describe writing as an obsessive compulsive disorder. Making anything is an obsessive compulsive disorder, but thank God for it, you know?
Thank you.
And by the way, I don't mean that to be, self-congratulatory. I mean, I am a fan of all arts and not afraid to say it and not afraid to say what I love and whom I love, you know?
Oh, tell us who you love.
Well, what in what area?
Tell us what you read.
Right now, I'm reading Julian Barnes' Arthur and George, which is superb. If you don't know it, it's a historical novel, and it's about a true incident, apparently. And the Arthur is Arthur Conan Doyle. And apparently, he put his detective talents to work on a case of racial prejudice in England in its time. It's very fascinating, wonderful book. I've just towards the end of Orhan Pamuk's Snow, first time I've ever read him, and I was just charmed by it. It seems to me, weirdly, certainly a Russian influence because of Turkey and Russia, but it also seems to me like a Haruki Murakami novel almost. It's just got that just one step short of reality, you know? It's beautiful, beautiful writing. In film, don't go crazy now, but and I do love Bergman. I love Kurosawa. I've seen all those films. I treasure them. I like old movies. My favorite movie, I'm sorry, folks, is The Big Lebowski, which I've seen about 10 times. I worship the Coen brothers. I'm sorry. I listen to rock, contemporary rock and roll as well. The Mars Volta, do you know the Mars Volta? Francis the Mute, they are just marvelous. I have eclectic taste. I still listen to my old jazz albums. Here's something I've never told you. I still have the first album I ever bought. Now, it's a little scratchy, and I do realize the CD is easier to play, but I still have it, and it's a John Coltrane album. He was my hero. I was a saxophone player as a kid, and I was trying to figure out, what is he doing? It's the first time that I ever understood the greatness of an artist. I didn't understand how. And I would blow along, of course, the melody at least, but once he started doing these crazy changes and chord changes and key changes, I was lost. And incidentally, I got back into music. Once I got out of undergraduate school, I was living with a bunch of people in a house, and didn't we all do that? We all lived with a bunch of people in a house. And one woman whom I was very enamored of, who played piano and wrote her own songs, what could I do? You know, I'd given up the saxophone. Meanwhile, a friend in another band had got kicked out of the band and left his drums there. And I went into my drumming phase. Oh, my Lord. I drummed with her, and then I began to just drum obsessively all day long. If I were sitting here now, I'd be drumming. I drummed on phone books, on the dashboard of the car, everywhere, all the time, until all the other people moved out of the house and left. They left. They could hear me. They said they moved to a place like a half a mile away. They could hear me at night drumming. I couldn't stop. I just drummed everywhere forever by myself with playing very loud music and drumming. And it lasted about a year. How was I cured of this? One day I came home, and the drums were gone. My friend got in another band and took them. Subsequent to this, when I moved to L.A., my wife said to me, "Why are you dragging that saxophone around? You never play it." And I began to play again. But not jazz, rock and roll. Because rock and roll, you just need to know the blues scale, and you can play anything. You can hear it, and you can play it. And you can feel it. The drums allowed me to feel the rhythm and what it's supposed to be. And then I get into a band, the Ventilators, in which I was the singer. And that's what I could do best. But I couldn't have done any of that if from the academic way of studying music is fine. I could sight read. I could play the living hell out of it, but it didn't know what it was supposed to be. And it wasn't until rock and roll that I discovered what it is, and to feel, just to feel it. You don't need to read sheet music unless it's very elaborate. You can just kind of do it.
Well, I just understood T.C. Boyle. He's a force of human nature, you know. And I want to thank you all for coming, and thank you.
Shall we get up and take a bow?
Thank you.
I'll sign your books for you. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Dantica, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.